This is the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. Recent moves by the Lula government to increase the role of the state in the economy have worried some investors. How concerned should we be about the state of Latin America's largest economy?
We are at the very same old position where when we see economic growth is what's called the chicken flight, right? It's just like a brief takeoff. You grow timidly for a couple of years and then something happens and either political turmoil or economic intervention or something, and it draws the country back to recession or to a bad position. The flip side is that the very bad scenario, I don't think it is likely, at least for now, which would be the government tossing away the fiscal framework.
Regular listeners of this podcast are well aware that Brazil's economy performed better than expected last year, expanding almost 3%. But now, in 2024, the outlook is more complex. Agribusiness is not boosting the economy this year to the same extent, and all eyes are on the government, specifically whether President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and his Workers' Party might be falling into old habits of state intervention in the economy. The government has been trying to use its power to name its preferred leaders at state-run oil company Petrobras, as well as possibly at iron ore giant Vale. It's also planning to spend billions of dollars on new industrial policy initiatives, unnerving investors who see some parallels with the decisions the Workers' Party made when they were in power a decade ago, which led to a historic recession. Nobody expects a repeat of that this time around, thank goodness. But there are concerns that investment could slow down, and along with it, perhaps the economy as a whole. Today on the podcast, we'll try to take a nuanced look at the economic policy of the Lula government, look at the policy debates between the more fiscally minded finance minister, Fernando Haddad, as well as the Workers' Party president, Gleisi Hoffmann, who's trying to push for more state spending. We'll examine the role of Congress in this policy tug of war, try to understand what's going through Lula's head, as well as the minds of investors. We've invited Mario Braga for consultancy firm Control Risks. Mario is based in Sao Paulo and regularly speaks to investors as well as politicians. Mario, welcome to the AQ podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So Mario, as I said, 2023 was a good year for Brazil. 2024 looks a little more uncertain. Some investors are feeling a little bit spooked. What's your view? How does the economy feel right now in Brazil?
Well, I think there have been growing concerns in terms of what the final word in terms of economic policy making will be. We have been seeing some contrasting signals, perhaps some controversial, to say the least, the statements from President Lula himself. We have episodes involving large companies. We can talk about Vale, Petrobras. That comes down to what's the economic view of Lula himself and parts of the Workers' Party in the administration, that the state should have an increased role in the economy. And that means using state-owned companies for policy-making tools. And I think that's very clear and pretty much the case with what we have with Petrobras now. But when it comes to Vale, it's just a distorted notion of that, because Vale was privatized in the 90s, right? And the stake that the government has is very small and wouldn't give it any rights to have a claim, a legitimate claim. So it speaks about the willingness of the president and the administration to, if not directly interfere, but to have a very strong political influence in these large companies that are so large that they have an impact on the economy.
You and I have both been doing this for a long time. You're Brazilian. You work in risk analysis. I am sadly not Brazilian, but have been following your country for more than 20 years now. These are old issues. I mean, this question of how much and to what degree the state should intervene in these companies where they have the ability through shares that they hold is a debate that we have seen in Brazil going all the way back to the 1990s. Can you spell out for our audience who might not follow Brazil on a day-to-day basis why this round of debate is concerning to people?
It's interesting because during Lula's two first terms, you had the stock market performing well. You had economic growth on the back of commodities booms and everything.
The stock market quadrupled, as I recall. And those were good years for everybody.
The issue, and I think that the jitters you have, is with how that story ended, right? And that's the second term of the end of the second term of Lula's administration, and mostly what happened in the economy under his chosen successor, Dilma Rousseff, which was a much more interventionist approach, interfering with price dynamics, with specific sectors, and how that kind of unfolded into a two-year recession, the longest and deepest in Brazil's history. So the concern, I think, that everyone is looking and pay attention to now is, will this be back? Will this playbook, the perception among market participants is that ended terribly wrong and bad for the economy, will these same practices return to the control, to who's in control of economic policymaking?
How do you see Lula in the middle of all this, and how do you see the broader power dynamics?
Basically, I see Lula himself more aligned to the left than to the center, but there are constraints that prevent him from pursuing policies that he believes would be the best option. That there are three pillars that constrain Lula. The first of them is his limited popularity. So the electoral result was super tight, less than 2 percentage points. The other is precisely the coalition. Lula had to bring people that are perceived as more centrist and more moderate. We're talking specifically about the main ones, Geraldo Alckmin as the vice president, but also Simone Tebet as the planning minister, and among others, and of course, the people these people bring with them. But they are in positions that are important enough. So when you think about the planning ministry, and they being there, they prevent that these other voices that are more unorthodox occupy places that would have more power in terms of policymaking. And just to finalize, like the third one is Congress that has been acting as a check against these anti-business measures or business that would interfere with market dynamics. And of course, Fernando Haddad being the head of the finance ministry, him being someone that is indeed more centrist, we have this composition where what we saw in 2023 was very far from, for example, what domestic investors expected. That would be a very radical left-wing presidency.
Do you feel like Lula learned anything from the collapse of the mid-2010s? I mean, what's your sense based on what he says and what members of his party say about the lessons from that era?
I think that there are some lessons learned, but perhaps not to the extent that they could have been. When we think that most of the programs and the policies introduced last years are just a rebranding of the very same old programs, or that Lula is still focusing on boosting credit, if he could interfere in the central bank or in monetary policy to some extent to cut down rates more aggressively, he would. So I think he still has this very same playbook, and he thinks that resorting to those recipes would have the same impact, not acknowledging that a lot of the elements, these are moving parts and they have changed. So I think the country sometimes is not looking forward or even looking at the present situation and adapting to what it's needed at the present moment.
What Lula might say, or somebody from his economic team might say, is that they inherited a situation that was with a social emergency in the wake of the pandemic in a country that still has one of the world's biggest gaps between rich and poor. And so they have to manage the economy, in their view, in a way that accounts for some of that and tries to redistribute income. And by the way, just look at our economic record the first time, we're not going to go crazy. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Increasing in social spending, public spending, all of this was expected. I think, again, the question is to which extent. And in that regard, there is a tug of war. There's clearly a tug of war within the administration in which Haddad, the finance minister, is this voice that at least tries to instill fiscal discipline. And the fact that he has been able to prevent the administration from abandoning fiscal discipline altogether, I think that's a positive development. And the The big challenge here, of course, because of all the budgetary constraints that Brazil's budget has, the limited space for investment, the limited public investment capacity and everything, is how to allocate all these requirements and demand social calls for investment and services in a very limited budget. And that's where, when we think about the planning ministry role comes in, or these debates of, we have ideally to improve the quality of public expenditure in Brazil. But that takes time. That is something that I don't think would change drastically in a couple of years.
I want to talk about some specifics now. Industrial policy. The government launched a new industrial policy plan earlier this year. They said that they want to spend 300 billion reais, which is the equivalent of about $60 billion in the country's industries. And this is an interesting topic because, you know, industrial policy has been around in Brazil for a long time. It is now kind of in fashion in the United States with the so-called Inflation Reduction Act and parts of Europe as well. I talked to Brazilian friends who kind of watch what's happening in the United States, and they say, aha, finally, you guys are catching up. Almost feel like they invented it. But it has been a source of investor concern. It's been weighing on markets because of these fears that essentially the state is not the best allocator of capital. What's your assessment of that initiative right now? And what do we know? Because at the beginning, details were actually quite scarce.
I think there is a nuanced approach to the impacts it will have. The way we see it is that these new policies are unlikely to significantly improve the state of the country's industrial sector, in part because it does not address structural bottlenecks. So we can talk about the country's closeness to global trade. We can talk about the quality of infrastructure, the lack of still skilled human capital. But on the other side, it does have some positives. And I think the integration of green initiatives, which is part of a broader rhetoric of this administration, is certainly one of them. And this is something where we see that there is demand from investors. There is interest from companies either operating in the country or private equity, sovereign funds, that this is a sector where Brazil becomes a must-see country for them to consider in their investment decisions. So I think, again, it's a mixed bag in what these new policies can make, but the lack of detail and the lack of what exactly the government envisions to accomplish, it makes it harder for especially these long-term investment decisions.
You speak to a lot of investors, both inside and outside of Brazil. Where is the interest right now? I mean, is it mostly in agribusiness, which was such a big driver of the economy in 2023, or are there some surprising areas as well?
Yeah, I think Brazil continues to be the destination for sectors that are no-brainers to some extent. So when we think about the extractive industry, we still see a lot of activity in the mining sector, lithium in the wave of the energy transition and all the interest. We have seen interest growing in northern Minas Gerais state because of lithium, oil and gas in that same extractive space. I think the new wave and something that has been stable and growing, and I think this trend will persist, is renewables. So a lot of interest, both from investors in assets and companies operating in the country, but solar and wind parks and offshore wind farm. We have seen some progress in terms of regulatory frameworks that at least reduce legal uncertainty. But again, on the other side, the flip side of that is you still need to develop a supply chain. You still need to improve infrastructure. When we talk about generating energy, we still need the transmission lines to connect them to the grid. So there are still challenges. But I think these two areas are very clear that their interest is there regardless of this political noise or uncertainties on those fronts. What I think that there could be more interest, and you see some talk from people in government, but I don't think that has actually translated yet, is to this notion of, oh, since supply chains globally are in a kind of realignment process, and we are not as close to the United States as Mexico to claim that we are that we are able to be kind of this nearshoring destination. But we could be the destination for companies that want to have a clean operation or very limited carbon footprint. And I don't think we're there yet.
For anybody who thinks that Brazil might be too distant to participate in the nearshoring phenomenon, I was surprised late last year to hear U.S. officials talk about Brazil actually in very glowing terms as a possible beneficiary of the organization of supply chains. And what they said was, look, behind Mexico, this is still the most sophisticated industrial park in Latin America. And maybe it's a little too far away to call it nearshoring. Maybe you call it friend shoring or ally shoring or something like that. But that there are still areas where, you know, Brazil might be able to make a difference.
I totally agree. And I think that there is the space and the opportunity that Brazil and the current government could be enjoying. But you don't see, for example, a rhetoric, even a rhetoric at the rhetorical level from the president saying anything like that that could entice and at least strengthen the interest in that kind of realignment.
Yeah, my feeling, and we've talked about Brazil's foreign policy a lot on this podcast, so we won't dwell on this, but my feeling is that any kind of overt nearshoring, the Lula government sees that as being in conflict with their broader goal of seeking multipolarity or non-alignment. And so that's more important to them maybe at this stage.
We'll be back with more after a short break. The America's Society's Art Gallery at 680 Park Avenue in New York is a truly amazing venue for art from Latin America and the Caribbean. Right now, the gallery is showing the second part of the exhibition, El Dorado Myths of Gold, which presents artworks from the pre-colonial period to today and uses the myth of the so-called Golden City as a framework for understanding the Americas. El Dorado Myths of Gold will be on view until May 18th, 2024.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk specifically about Petrobras. As I mentioned earlier, debates about exactly how state-run oil company should be, these happen all over the world. We see a lot of debate around Pemex right now in Mexico with the election that's underway there. But, you know, some things are going on at Petrobras right now. The CEO, Jean-Paul Prates, as we record this, is seen as likely to be on his way out. The current head of the State Development Bank, BNDES, Aloysio Mercadante, is seen as a candidate to be on his way in. What, just, you know, a couple minutes here for our audience, what does all this tell you? What's happening at the company right now?
So what is happening at Petrobras is a reflection of this broader tug of war we mentioned earlier. I think what we have now is the current CEO, Jean-Paul Prates, as someone who is more moderate, more centrist, and someone who is trying to reconcile the interests of both either Lula or these more PT hardliners or people that push for Petrobras to have this very significant role, either in directing investments for specific sectors or assets. So say, we're going to use Petrobras to rebuild the shipping industry in Brazil, which is another thing that has been coming and going under the Workers' Party administrations, or to increase Brazil's refining capacity, or even to boost job generation. So he is not entirely aligned with that. And what he's pursued is kind of halfway and also try to meet markets' interests and demands. So when you think that his proposal for all that debate over whether Petrobras would or not distribute extraordinary dividends, what he proposed was, well, let's go ahead and distribute only 50%. It's like almost literally meeting these divergent interests halfway. But that is not enough for part of this group that says, well, that money could still be used for public investment, for some sort of investment. So we should just scrap dividends, scrap the divestment plan, to some extent, make a U-turn from what we had seen over the past 4 years under Bolsonaro and use Petrobras as a political instrument, a policy-making tool.
It's worth pointing out that there was some politicization of Petrobras under Bolsonaro as well. Bolsonaro appointed three political allies to Petrobras's board. even though many people worried that they lacked industry experience. But look, I want to move a little bit beyond Lula here and talk about some of these other political power centers that are important to the Brazilian economy, and specifically Congress. And, you know, what political analysts will tell you about Brazil is that one big change over the last 10 years, you know, the power that Congress has, some people even talk about it as a semi-presidentialist system. Now, that might be overstating a bit, but the point is some of these figures like Arthur Lira, the president of the House of Deputies, or Rodrigo Pacheco, who's the head of the Senate, are very, very powerful, not just with veto power over the president's agenda, but really the ability to, in practice, make policy. Can you tell us a little bit about who the key figures are and what they think about the economy, which interests they're responding to?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is one of the key underlying changes in terms of kind of institutional developments in Brazil. So executive, legislative relations, and how that reflects in policymaking. So the way we look at the composition of Congress, we try, perhaps it's kind of oversimplifying, but I think it helps understanding what's at stake and in which situations the government will have the ability to pass or not legislation. But we look at the coalition, most of it that was with Lula in the first round of the presidential elections. And that amounts to around a quarter of federal deputies. So these are more like not only the PT, but some parties on the left. On the other side of the spectrum, you have the PL that Bolsonaro to some extent leads, but also Partido Novo that are more on the right side, and they account for 20% of the seats. That means that we have 55% of federal deputies that are not automatically aligned with the administration, in spite of the fact that some of them even have cabinet seats, right? So that's how drastic power has changed, that nowadays it's not enough for you to give a party representation in the cabinet. You still have to negotiate on a case-by-case basis or depending on what's at stake, right? And what we see, and I think this explains a lot why in 2023, the economic agenda advanced rather quickly. And of course, it demanded a lot of negotiations from Fernando Haddad. But the fact that this pro-business agenda, the tax reform, other sector-specific frameworks, like the carbon credit market or things like that, these interests of the administration overlap with the interests of the legislative branch. And as you mentioned, very specifically, the Speaker of the House, Arthur Lira, as being basically the whip, someone. And I think Lira is in a position that he has been reelected president, the Speaker of the House. So in February next year, his term ends. And that lies the question, what will be his political future? And him positioning himself as this pro-business, someone who prevented the government from either increasing taxes or cutting subsidies or adopting measures that would cut jobs or something like that. I think he is the way that he sees he can retain part of this political capital.
As we come to the end here, Mario, and kind of look for a takeaway, doesn't this sound like an economy, the Brazilian economy, that's going to continue to grow most years about 2%? Sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. These, you know, policy debates that sometimes spook investors, where you get some decisions more in a pro-market way, some that come in a more pro-state way. But, and you know, that's an ideological battle that will never truly be resolved, but ends up with some sort of balance because of the countervailing forces in Congress that you talked about. I mean, is that where we are, or do you see some possibility that there could be either worse outcomes or better outcomes, depending on how things go?
No, I agree with you, Brian. I think that we are at the very same old position where when we see economic growth is what's called the chicken flight, right? It's just like a brief takeoff. You grow timidly for a couple of years and then something happens and either political turmoil or economic intervention or something, and it draws the country back to recession or to a bad position.
just to explain that one, that the idea is that that's how a chicken flies, that it flaps its wings and then it finally gets off the ground, but it doesn't go very high before it comes back to earth. Just for people out there who've never actually seen a chicken try to fly before.
And it just speaks to the lack of structural solutions or measures that could improve the country's productivity levels or the quality of its labor force. Or I think the tax reform will be one that will have this impact, but the transition period is 10 years. So it's something that we're going to see more concrete impact very further down the road. And then what we have now is, well, the economy in 2024, there have been increases in the economists' forecasts, but we are talking about barely 2%, which is below what the IMF estimates for the global economy of around 3%, and just half of what the IMF forecasts for developing economies of 4%. So it still shows how Brazil is lagging behind. And as you were mentioning earlier, when we think about Mexico that has the nearshoring leverage to pull, when we think about India that is becoming this not only geopolitical force, but also the tech sector, the cheap labor that enables it to integrate more easily, and the language, of course, but with global supply chains. So I think all of that leaves Brazil behind. The flip side is that the very bad scenario, I don't think it is likely, at least for now, which would be the government tossing away the fiscal framework, which has been something that, although there's a debate around whether or not it's ideal or to which extent it will actually limit the increase of public expenditure, but I think it's there. It has served its purpose of at least reducing the concerns of market participants over a center-left, a left-wing administration. And Fernando Haddad, the finance minister, is doing all he can to at least secure that this framework will remain in place, and we'll see if adjustments are needed. It's very unlikely that he will meet the target to balance out expenses and revenues. But just the fact that it's there, it sends a strong signal. If that goes away, then we have seen the mood of the business souring, investors going away, the exchange rate depreciating, and all the kind of a fallout of the economic conditions. But I don't think that we are near there, and that's not anything close to the baseline scenario.
Mario, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly Podcast is produced by Luisa Franco and edited in partnership with Human Group Media.